The Discourse on Loving Kindness, or the Metta Sutta, is a text that appears in a collection of the early Buddhist discourses called the Sutta Nipata. And there's several collections of discourses, teachings by either the Buddha or his disciples, or said to be by the Buddha or his disciples, that are part of what's called the Pali Canon. Pali is the language of early Buddhism, nowadays used by the Theravada lineage, mostly by Buddhists from Sri Lanka, Thailand, and Burma, which is my primary lineage. And the primary lineage behind, again, Spirit Rock and IMS, Gaia House in England, and other centers, Insight Meditation Center on the peninsula. And so this tradition preserved in a beautiful way texts and discourses and teachings that are really the earliest layer we have left of what the Buddha taught. They were probably written down 300 or 400 years after the life of the Buddha, so they were preserved in oral tradition and through chanting for some time before they were written down. And they are rather voluminous. There's several volumes of these. It's a beautiful large collection, and it's one of the clearest collections of both historical and doctrinal information that's available about this period in yoga, several hundred years before the Common Era. These are texts that predate Patanjali, that predate the Bhagavad Gita, that predate much of the classical yoga tradition. And they come from the era of the early Upanishads. And so they have a connection to the earliest layers of yoga. And so this discourse, the Metta Sutta, in the commentaries comes with a story. And the story is this, that in the community of the Buddha there was once a bunch of monks who wanted to go off and practice in the forest. Particularly, they wanted to practice in this remote, dense grove of trees that was said to be haunted, or to be, that's sort of our modern word, but like to have these forest spirits that were a little unfriendly or grumpy residing in it. But they wanted to go and practice there, this deep forest grove. And you know, if you've been in a grove like that, what that's like, you know. Like, I'm out hiking, and it's, you know, it's trails and meadows and forests, and every once in a while you walk into a grove where it's just, like, dense or dank, and, like, there's a couple of these up in the East Bay Hills that I'm just, like, la, 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 cruising through, you know, Redwood Regional Park or something, and suddenly, like, mossy branches are overhanging the trail, and the redwoods are hugging in, and it's in a hollow, and the cliff sides go up, and there's just, like, a density to the forest there, and the tone shifts there. In the early Buddhist tradition, and still in many of the Asian Buddhist nations like Thailand and Burma, it's understood that prominent natural formations like groves of trees, like important trees themselves, are the homes of spirits, deities of certain kinds that we might call fairies even, or, you know, the subtle beings. And so the early Buddhist texts are full of these. Deities of various kinds come to visit the Buddha. Tree spirits come, forest spirits come, river spirits come, deities from different heaven realms come and visit the Buddha, and he teaches them. Or the nuns teach them. The Buddha, monks and nuns, have relationships with these spirits. And this isn't just ancient myth, but this is true kind of up into the 20th century, there are stories of the great monks and nuns in this tradition, in the Thai forest tradition particularly, teaching spirits and deities. The great teacher Ajahn Mun was said to give some of his time to teaching humans, but a lot of his time to teaching deities. And his student, Ajahn Mahabua, this great fierce monk, in the biography of his teacher, Ajahn Mun, said that, like, one time he was kind of spying on his teacher. His teacher was, like, sort of off in the woods, and Mahabhu was kind of looking at him, like, what's he doing? Who's he talking to? And he was walking along through forest paths, talking to nobody, right? But he was teaching spirits. He was teaching in the heaven realms, the spirit realms, and he was conversing with these deities. And you can take these stories as literal, you can take them as myth, you can take them as fantasy, you can take them as psychological metaphor, you know. But the tradition is full of them. So I prefer to just take them more or less literally as a way of saying, who knows what's real, actually? And every culture in the world has beings who converse with the immaterial realms. So I just had an argument on Facebook with some secular materialists who don't like this view, but so you can do whatever you like with it, really, as that's always true. But in this story, the monks go to this grove of trees. They want to practice, and so they start to do their meditation, and they start to hear noises, and they start to kind of sense that there's something there, and they get scared, which one does when you go out into a dank grove of trees, and it's nighttime, and you're alone. And there might be four spirits, there might just be tigers. Like, this is the jungles of North India in a relatively untamed time. At the very least, tigers. And if not that, then like grumpy tree spirits. So the monks go running back to the Buddha, and they say, Blessed One, we tried to practice, but we could not. Our minds were a mess, we were afraid. And the Buddha says, go back to the grove, but practice in this way. Here's your practice. Instead of meditating on the breath or whatever else you were doing, do this. Go back, generate the feeling of kindness, of friendliness, of love, and then radiate it out through your body in all directions, filling the field around you with love. And the text literally talks about it in a directional way. It says that the meditator kind of radiates out to the in the front or in the one quarter, as if that's like 25%, 29%, you know, front side, both sides, both back. So the four quarters is the four compass directions around you, radiates the feelings of loving kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity in all directions, above and below. So basically, go back to the grove and meditate on love. And not just on the quality of it and feel it, but actually send it outward. The monks go and do this. Their fear evaporates, first of all. It's hard to be, you can't be afraid and loving at the same time, right? So yeah, it's one or the other. So in a very basic psychological way, the Buddha's meditation was a wonderful one. He said, you're afraid. Don't try to fix the fear, but bring the quality of love into your being. And then the story says that the forest spirits really liked that. And they were like, oh, these monks are great. And they start like gathering around. You know, when somebody's like radiating kindness, of course you want to be near them, right? It feels so good. And so the spirits not only stop being grumpy and trying to frighten the monks away, but they become their protectors. And they keep all other kind of harmful forces or beings away. One of the nuns that I know and a teacher of mine and who runs a community that we love to support. This is a nun named Aya Ananda Bodhi, or the bliss of awakening. And she says, oh, she says in the most matter-of-fact way, she says, oh, the devas, this is the spirits, the devas love metta, you know, and they love babies, you know. All of that kindness and love, they just gather around, they love that. So you're doing metta, the spirits gather around. So who knows, literal or not, but that's the story. Metta dispels fear. That's the take home there. So this is the discourse that comes out of or is framed by that story. And so for the next few weeks, we're going to talk about this. And I'm just going to start at the beginning. This is a very classical way to teach, kind of. We'll go line by line and just see what this this short evocative text on the power of heart practice has to offer us. And the text begins like this. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. So first of all, it's instructions. This is what should be done. We don't like shoulds in California in the 21st century, you know. I think because a lot of us grew up in a kind of moralistic, kind of Protestant moralistic environment where there's lots of shoulds. You know, you should be good, you should be nice, you should be clean, you should be work hard, yada yada. There's all these shoulds. So this is not a should in that way. Because it says this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. Skilled in goodness is a beautiful way of saying that the practices of doing good, the practices of ethical action and kindness are not innate. They're not, maybe there's an aspect of them that's innate, like in the saying from the civil rights era, you know, children, no child is born racist. Children have to be taught to be racist. So in a certain way, kind of love or kindness is in a certain way innate to us as animals. We're connection animals. But goodness in action is really a skill. It has to be developed and practiced. And we teach our children how to do it, and we practice it. We get good at it or not, depending on how much energy and sincerity and conditions and support we have in practicing it. So this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. I think knowing the path of peace doesn't mean has already walked the path of peace, but because, of course, if you had already walked it and you were finished with it, there's no should to be done anymore. Should to be done means it's a practice. This is something to be cultivated or developed. So it's a little bit like, I'm going to tell you the path to New York. If you want to take the quick way, it's called Route 80. It starts at the Bay Bridge, and it ends with the George Washington Bridge in Upper Manhattan. And if you just stay on it, and you don't take too many detours, you get there, barring natural disasters and road work, etc. So Route 80 goes to New York. That's the path. And if New York was awakening, Route 80 would be the path of peace, the path of getting to awakening, closer and closer. Skilled in goodness and what should be done is a little bit like, well, how do you traverse that path? You know, what's the engine that takes you there? Let's say we have to walk it, because, you know, what good is a path if you just have a fast car? There's no fast car. The tantrics pretend they have a fast car, but it's still just walking. It's energized walking. Maybe it's flying sometimes, but it's your body doing it. Let's say we have to walk, just to stay humble. How do you walk? You have to learn to walk. You have to learn to walk skillfully. You have to walk in a way that doesn't injure yourself. So like not pushing too hard, not injuring your body. All of this is a metaphor in a way. So then these teachings are really like teachings on how to walk. How do you walk the path of peace? The Buddhist path often is said to begin with the practice of generosity. That's the first practice often taught. Learn how to let go a little bit of our possessions we cling to and be generous to others. Originally, that probably meant be generous to the monastics because they need it, right? They live on the generosity of lay people. And the monastics themselves, everything they do is generosity, giving back the teachings, practicing in order to free beings. Not being a drain on resources, but uplifting the whole community, living simply. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. In a way, all the teachings are skilled in goodness. And this text is going to begin with skilled in goodness, meaning the foundation in the ethical practices. So this is a text that takes us all the way through the path from the beginning to the end with the the heart practice as the through line. And so this second sentence is really a list of qualities in like how to practice goodness. So here's a little map for kind of the foundation of yogic practice. Let them be able and upright. Just to say, because it's using the translation, it's an old translation, before there was such a word as ableism. This doesn't mean let them be, you know, necessarily one who walks or has a certain kind of physical capacity. I think able and upright here refer to a kind of energy brought to practice. I'm gonna bring my skills and my qualities to bear, whether I walk or I ride a wheelchair, whether I sit or stand, whether I'm physically strong or weak. The text is going to go on to say, you know, weak or strong, omitting none. So this isn't an exclusive statement. I think it's a quality of the heart that can be brought to practice. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech. The speech practices are hard. They ask us to be truthful, to be kind, to be clear, to speak that which is appropriate and helpful and timely. And this is challenging, you know, in a world where we might even say that a certain kind of righteous anger is sometimes appropriate, to say, let them be straightforward and gentle in speech, might seem like it's saying, like, oh, just be kind of quiet and passive. And there's a fine line to ride here. I don't think it means passive at all. I also don't think it means scream and shout because you have a view and you're angry about what's happening. But there's a balance in there somewhere that doesn't wilt from confrontation, but also doesn't inflame it. And just to say already that these are not, these are all practices. Like able and upright is a practice. I don't feel able and upright some days, you know. I have to work at bringing my energy clearly to practice. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech. A couple days ago, in one of the institutions that I take part in, I was part of a email exchange. Something was being organized, and someone wrote back saying, you know, in a kind of kind but firm way, hey, I think a couple of y'all are out of line. This is not what we're doing here. And immediately my whole system, I don't like conflict. This is my little psychology. Ah, no, somebody's upset. Even though I didn't think I had done anything wrong, I actually felt like I had communicated clearly and to whatever extent, maybe I had a little tiny misunderstanding. But just the presence of like someone being not completely pleased with something I had done, and for like kind of for about 8 hours, there was this like hot, vibrating thing in my whole body, where I could notice that I'm mindful of it. I'm like, oh, activated, and I'm just like burning up, and I'm just like, oh, somebody's not happy, and it's such a feeling. You might be familiar with a feeling like that or not, who knows. But, so I hung out with it and I processed it a little bit. I talked about it with my sweetheart and eventually some emails went back and forth, and it turned out that the person who wasn't entirely happy was, you know, just kind of spoke in a straightforward and clear way, and me and somebody else spoke in a straightforward and clear way. And look, straightforwardness did it. We all said what was true and transparent. And, you know, it turned out to be okay, right? Tell my little child system that. Look, it turned out to be okay. You're not in trouble, right? I only have to tell myself this, you know. You're not in trouble. Like, oh, Amazing. Straightforward. Straightforward is a profound speech practice that it's a little bit like something's happening, and it's always a little complicated. Relationship is complicated. People are complicated. Why they keep being complicated, I don't know, but it seems to happen. But straightforward turns out in a certain way to be almost like my core practice, where it's like, whatever's happening, I want to insist that instead of like trying to figure it out or play the game or do the drama right or be kind of say just the right thing so that it kind of turns out the way that I want, what if I was just transparent and be like, oh, this is what I feel, this is what I think, this is what I did or am doing or want to do. And in a kind of like, it's a little bit like when I was in South Asia, I never got used to the practice of bargaining for things. You know, I'm like, how much is the shawl? And the guy's like, for you, 200 rupees, even though it's usually 500. And I find out later that for someone else it's 50. And that it's a cultural thing. Like it's not, they're not trying to cheat me. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. It doesn't matter. But I'm just not used to it. And I don't like the feeling of that little thing that to my system felt like conflict. It's totally like me as a wilting Californian, you know. But I was never taught to bargain. And even now, when I have to negotiate a contract with someone, I hate it. It's just like, Because what my system wants, and I think that this teaching supports me a little bit in my psychology of liking this, that it just feels really good to me to be able to say, you know, here's where I'm at, and to just trust or ask that the world goes, cool, here's where we're at, and have it be not a game. And that's maybe a little unrealistic. That's my, perhaps, like, monastic side, being like, what if I could just absolutely not lie or fluff or anything, but just be like, cards on the table. Never have cards here. Just like, here I am. For me, there's a quality in that is, that relieves a tension in my heart. Could I just be open? And then that becomes a practice. That's a skill in goodness that we have to cultivate again and again and again, because openness isn't just a thing that I can will and do and be like, may I now be open? And then like, oh, I'm open. It turns out that like I can have that intention, but like we were saying in the beginning, like the heart sometimes opens, it sometimes closes. And it opens and closes based on conditions. And those conditions are complex. Right? The conditions, they largely consist of other people. That would be hell in Sartre's universe. That's from the existentialist Sartre, his great play called No Exit, where you find yourself in a room with a bunch of people and one door, and only after a while do you realize that you're in hell. And the great line from the play is, oh my God, like, hell is other people. Of course, hell is only other people if hell for you is other people. Somebody else in the room is like, heaven is other people. This is so good. We're just together forever. But that's not existentialism. Existentialism really was hell is other people. So other people are complicated. And so conditions are what influence us to be open or closed in a moment. And this is really nervous system biology at this point. Basically, sometimes I feel safe and sometimes I feel unsafe. And there's subtle shifts in relationship that cause that, right? I'm talking with someone or somewhere, and a little flicker of something goes across someone's face. I don't even consciously notice it, but my system closes down a little bit. Sometimes I do consciously notice it, and I'm often what the mind will do is make up a story, right? Oh, he doesn't like me, you know? Or, oh, he or she wants something from me. I never know if that's true or not, right? Those are stories. They might be. They might be just projection. But what the body does is it responds to signal, whatever that is. I mean, a grove of trees, and I just get this hunch, and the system activates. Right? The monks were scared. In a way, the condition around us is what enables the heart to open or close initially. And then the practice, this is why it's a skill that needs to be cultivated, a skill that should be cultivated. The practice is to learn how to relate with or meet that shift in conditions. Not just with the habitual contraction or fear, but with a different response. This has interesting implications. There's the possibility that yogic practice actually teaches us to expand the possibilities of our experience beyond what our organic biology or our kind of habitual evolutionary biology suggests. In other words, I learn to tolerate discomfort. I learn to be in situations that are initially uncomfortable where I don't feel safe without completely shutting down or giving in to the self-protective impulse. I feel it. Then I stay awake to complexity and something else happens. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways. These are just a list of awesome qualities. Humble and not conceited, this is good. Contented and easily satisfied, this is good. Not easy, but good. What would it be like to be easily satisfied? We think of content as like, you know, I feel good with what I've been given. Ah, I'm content. Contentment, you know, I could be content. Oh, well, I'm finally content because, you know, there's lots of money in the bank and a banquet of food and lots of friends. And there's abundance. That's okay, I'm content when there's abundance. But that's not so easy to come by. So contented and easily satisfied is like content, but also content without a lot of conditions. Like without a really complex thing needed to be content. Can you be content and still have 200 unanswered emails in your inbox? And not quite enough money saved for retirement? Student loans to pay off? An unresolved argument with your sweetheart? An ache in your knee that you really should go and look at? No chocolate in the fridge? Getting gray. But basically okay. What about content like that? Yeah, your favorite yoga teacher moved away. We elected beings. Easily satisfied, contented and easily satisfied. Easily satisfied is a profound practice. Try it out. Every once in a while, on any given day, especially the shitty ones, look around for a minute and be like, what if I could be just satisfied right now? Not by getting what I want, but actually by being easily satisfied. You know? Well, it's a nice room. Coffee was good this morning. Cool. You know, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. Unburdened with duties is awesome. It, of course, has a double meaning. Please be unburdened with duties, like don't have very many duties. That's one implication, perhaps, right? Simplify your life. Don't take on too much stuff. I have failed at this, totally burdened by duties. But of course, there's a second, subtler meaning to it, which is be unburdened by your duties. I'm at home, I'm in the kitchen, I'm complaining. I have so much to do. I have these projects. I'm late. I'm doing these things. I have to take care of the baby. He was grumpy today. It was hard. I'm tired. I have more to do. And my sweetheart, God bless her, will sometimes just say, unburdened by duties. Because we both love this text. She said, unburdened by duties. And I'm like, I feel so burdened, you know. But there's this possibility, unburdened by, and it's like, oh, I have all these duties. Okay, I'm a dad, of course I do. Like, just hella shit to do. What if I could be easily satisfied, unburdened by duties, even though I have them? And then maybe one day I get to be a monk again and actually not have very many for a few minutes. That's not the point. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. And that's the basic kind of renunciate stance. Not needing too much. Frugal. Frugal is not the most popular teaching in an abundance-oriented Bay Area. I read an article that was like, millennials would have a way easier time saving for retirement if they really would get over $9 avocado toast. Like, oh, you're really having a luxurious, abundant life here, but you're not saving for when you're old because you haven't quite realized yet that you will become old. We all did that, yada, yada. I didn't save shit till I was 40-something. Gen Xer, artist, super impractical, but I was frugal. So this text points to, in this paragraph, in this opening, as the deep foundation of the path, not any profound cultivation, not unbinding the self yet, four or five paragraphs on, we'll get to that, but this is really just like, what are the qualities of one who can walk the path of peace in a sustainable, pleasurable, like sweet way? In our culture, this kind of person, I think there's lots of them, but they're kind of invisible. The ones who are just humble, straightforward and gentle, frugal, contented. As you practice this week and move through your days, every once in a while, just remember some of those words. Let them kind of float through and see what happens. Right? Humble, frugal, contented, easily satisfied. Easily satisfied is a nice mantra. Anything you're just doing, you're sitting in traffic, you might just be like, easily satisfied. I'm like, you know? I could be like, nice song on the radio. Water looks pretty. Cool. So we'll go on next week on into the formal practice of wishing all beings to be at ease. We'll go on. So take a moment. Let's just sit before we open into discussion and see what resonates in this like list of these simple qualities for you. You might notice not just lack, like, oh, I'm so not content or not frugal. See if you can notice the ones that you have or are in even a little way. The moments when you've known what contentment feels like or humility or simple satisfaction. Let's hear a little bit from you. What do you think? What do you feel as you hear this, the beginning of this text here? Yeah.
So when you started to read this about metta, I was very much wanting to understand how to have metta for myself. It's much easier for me to feel it outwards. And I was feeling an inherent tension with kind of the way that you talked about your email exchange being authentic and simple and direct, and with feeling anxiety, not knowing what that is, or not sure how to be simple, honest, and direct, and wanting to hold that, but not having access to it, and being in that place where maybe not knowing who to be, or like as a mother, or as a role, not knowing, do I be this or do I be that, and trying to create a container where I feel safe and clean and clear, and simultaneously being very honest, well, I'm confused. So could you talk
I mean, that's really the start, you know, to be honest in that way, both with others, but and really as a first step with ourself, to say like, oh, I want to be kind of open and straightforward and transparent and available, but actually I'm confused, you know, or I feel that I should be something, but I don't know what, and to actually identify the feeling just of not knowing or confusion. And be like, okay, I don't know. I don't know, and I'm confused, and confused feels like this. That's quite straightforward, you know. And maybe it's appropriate or not to bring that into external relationship, you know, to be in a conversation and say, you know, I hear what you're saying, and honestly right now, I just feel confused. Mm-hmm. But that is at least straightforward. It's transparent. We'll do the formal practice of metta for self next week, because for many folks, metta for ourselves is difficult. There's so much, we have so much self-judgment and shame and hatred for ourselves. And so in this tradition, we very often start with metta or loving kindness for any being it's just easy to generate the feeling for. You know, so, you know, I think of my baby, who's basically a pure kind of being, kind of halfway in the deity realms and halfway human at this point, right? And he's very easy to love, right? Because there's no complexity there. It's just like, oh, it's you, you're gorgeous. So, you know, I start with that. When we turn the lens toward ourself, and we'll do that practice next week and talk about it, we have to both, we continue to generate the feeling, but we also, the feeling is going to come into contact with more complexity, with my own confusion or my wanting and all of those layers that you're naming. And so I think as a practice, this is a little bit of a paradox, but it starts with not trying to be any different than I am. Even though I'm also trying to cultivate loving kindness. If I think that that's what I should be feeling, that's not going to work either. Right. I have to actually be like, you know, like my intention is to be more loving toward myself, and when I turn toward myself, what I actually notice is a lot of blame, say. Okay. And I have to be honest with that for myself and just be like, okay, that's blame. I want to love myself, but instead I find blame. And to hang out with that, with the inappropriate conditions, you know, and especially in a meditative way. So not just like thinking about, not reinforcing it, which we do all the time, but actually contacting the feeling in a more energetic, you know, or intuitive way. Metta practice is really like an emotional processing practice. Before we can radiate kindness in all directions, we have to actually feel all the places where that kindness gets blocked. We will inevitably feel those places where that kindness gets blocked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are there other thoughts? Yeah.
That I can practice some of these more easily. Like I have learned, at least in some ways in my life, to be easily satisfied, to be frugal. I'm a millennial and I've never bought avocado toast. So.
You might at some point. It's lovely, but you know, good going.
And so it's challenging for me to recognize those things that I'm doing and also stay humble and not conceited, like not letting ego get in the way of moving in the right direction in some ways, but still staying down to earth.
Yeah. You know, if it's a challenge finding love for yourself because you have a lot of self-hatred, it's a different challenge if you think you're super awesome and you've got your shit together, you know.
Well, I'm not there yet.
Well, there. So you're not, no worries, right? See, that's humble. That was humble, that thing you just did. Humble is a delicate one because it's actually important to recognize clearly our strengths. And so what's the difference between seeing clearly that you have a good quality of any kind? Is that automatically conceit? We have to really know what conceit is then, you know. One way we can think about it is that conceit has a strong element of like identity in it. Like, I am a frugal person. I'm an awesome frugal person. And anytime there's identity, there's comparison and judgment. Well, I'm more frugal than those people over there, you know. And so then I might think of myself as better than. And so conceit is the quality of generating an identity that stabilizes itself through difference, through judgment, essentially. So when that's present, you want to see that as a quality, and that's an unwholesome quality, right? It increases distance between people. It decreases the possibility of being friendly. Recognizing your own good qualities, though, in a kind of clear-minded way, helps you to strengthen them, right? If you're like, oh, look, I've learned to be frugal. It's a good thing. It has stood me in good stead. I'm not addicted to avocado toast. And you might be like, and that's great, you know? It's like great not meaning I'm better than someone else, but great meaning like this supports my practice. This supports my well-being and my service in the world, and my health and well-being. And it's necessary to know and kind of appreciate our own good qualities. We might all watch out for thinking that any good quality is final, like that we got it all figured out. So mostly don't worry about it, I think. Other thoughts? Yes, sir.
Something that comes up for me is that the closer I feel with somebody, the less gentle in speech I am. And usually it's like because I was raised by New York Jews and it's just like how you talk to each other.
Yeah.
And it's not meant to be harmful.
Yeah.
And so sometimes people are like get that there's love and banter and have a good time with me. And sometimes it just like hits them and it's not helpful. And I wonder, like, how do you gauge what is gentle speech when there's these subjective viewpoints about that?
Yeah.
And I get, if I harm somebody, that's obviously not a good thing, but I find if I'm too quiet or too gentle, it just is, like, not expressing the passion or the love or the, like, camaraderie.
Totally.
Yeah.
Maybe for your family, like, a certain bigness would qualify as gentle in this sense. Like, I bet you know when there's that kind of, like, banter that has some pokiness to it within the culture you're describing coming from. I bet you know when it crosses over into actually being hurtful.
Sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Maybe there's another thing to say about this, which is that we live in a culture that that silences many voices and appreciates others. So if one is from any cohort or group that has traditionally been silenced, say women or people of color or non-upper-class, educated, Protestant, white, straight, cisgendered men, then it's actually appropriate to bring out the voice, even if it's not gentle, right? Like, it's appropriate for folks who've been oppressed to express anger through the voice. And so I wouldn't want us to overinterpret this as being like, oh, everyone should become quiet, especially in a culture that has wanted women particularly to be quiet. So I'm like, no, be loud. Maybe we want to more get at, like, what's it actually pointing to? And there's a way that all of this is pointing to what supports the path, the cultivation of peace in the heart. So it might be like, peace in my heart happens when my family is really, like, doing my family's thing. And it happens to be fairly, like, boom, boom, boom. But there's actually a peacefulness in the family when we're all on the same page. And maybe that's just perfect for that family. And, you know, perhaps there's other times when you're like, oh, that's just a little too kind of, it's not peaceful anymore in my heart, and I want to engage with it a little differently. And I would want that to be fully yours to decide, of course. So I don't think it's a rule. I don't think gentle necessarily means quiet or meek necessarily. I think it means, you know, really trying not to harm, as you're saying, trying not to indulge the energies of hatred or judgment or cruelty, you know, untruth. Yeah, something like that.
My follow-up question is, like, because I'm not sure what will end up stinging, like, when the banter has now gone too far or something, because I don't know that.
Yeah.
How do I then, like, be authentic to my nature of boisterous and also, like, cautious about harming?
Well, right. Sometimes you're going to go too far, and then you want to notice that. And you're like, oh, look, I was authentic, and now somebody's crying. You're like, okay, you know. Maybe that was a little too far, you know. And you become sensitive to the context of boisterousness. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a good place for boisterous, and there's other places not. Mm-hmm. And maybe you figure out your context, and you're like, oh, with this person, like, I can totally, like, let her rip. This other person, I channel my force in other ways. And that's always going to be true. Like, you behave differently when you're, you know, standing in line at the bank, or you're in church, or you're here practicing. You use your energy differently, hopefully in a way that's not inauthentic, but simply appropriate to context. You know? So yeah, sometimes you go too far. Other times you practice kind of holding back or skillfully channeling. And mostly I think that just means like staying in relationship, you know, knowing who you're with and what might be most nourishing for this person or people. Cool. Any last thoughts before we close for the night?
I just had a thought about that when you were talking about the bargaining and how I just recall numerous times when I said it's simple and straightforward, and it's sort of like, I'm not sure how this has been communicated to me, but it's kind of like a lack of intellect, you know, it's too simple, it's not. The game is figuring out the game is activating your brain so you can kind of understand the other person, and it's a way of communication, and that complexity is like part of using your brain, and if you're not doing that, then you're, it's implied that you're lazy or something, or not as intelligent.
Yeah, maybe so, you know. I think that this instruction is specific to one who wants to cultivate this particular path of peace. So it doesn't say, you know, if you want to get ahead in the world, you should be humble and not conceited, gentle and easy satisfied. If you want to get ahead in the world, you should probably be a little bit conceited, not content, dissatisfied, not gentle. All those things get you ahead, right? But this instruction is specific to, like, you want to resolve the tension of contraction and grasping in your own heart. So from that perspective, maybe it's not that important that you look smart or that you, you know, play the game well or anything. Maybe it's actually fine to be kind of a fool, because what you're doing is subtle. And you're actually being like, I don't actually care what others think. My practice is to like track the fluctuations in my heart, like moment to moment, and to keep orienting toward peacefulness, like water, kind of finding the Taoists would say, like, water is finds the low, the humble, the non-flashy path, but it always gets to where it's going. Right? It wears through rock to take the lowest path. So there's something that's profoundly humble in, like, yeah, not playing the game. I'm sure that for many of us, there's moments where that's appropriate, and again, moments where it's not, right? Like, we all have jobs and things to do. Like, you gotta be smart and play the game sometimes. Or you really figure out how to do that less and see what that's like sometimes to do less. Thanks for being here. It's a pleasure to chat with you about this. And as always, your generosity, your resources, keeps this whole thing going. We are here in this space because of the insistence on offering this group fully in gift economy. And so your generosity makes it possible for others, for everyone of any level of resources, to come and join us. Please practice generosity in this group to the extent that you feel inspired and able to do so. And I promise that for my part, those resources will be put as much as possible toward always keeping the group open and available for everyone. So may we all be well. May all beings everywhere be safe. May those who are close to tragedy this week be held in great kindness and compassion. And may the violence that infects our nation be quelled through love and legislation as appropriate. May we all be well. Thank you so much.